Question we can ask ourselves is, can we extend this idea of an effective potential a little bit further in order to gain some more insight into how particles move? The answer is yes. What you can do is saying, well, I will, rather than restrict myself to one particular star with one particular value of L sub z, and therefore one particular value of the circular orbit over here, I would just simply ask myself, what happens if I co-move with any circular orbit in such a potential? Let's then do this, because it will turn out that this is a very useful way of looking upon some similar systems that perhaps are not stellar systems, but that are n-body systems, which are useful and interesting in astrophysics. I refer in this case to section 3.2.3 of the book, when people are talking about nearly circular orbits. What one does is the following. You take a radial coordinate, which you define by the difference between the radial coordinate itself and some sort of fiducial value, namely the radius of the circular orbit that you want to co-move with. The effective potential, then, you can just simply copy from here if you wish, but what we're going to do is to use the fact that near this circular orbit, as we discussed in the previous lecture, that near this circular orbit, the potential can be approximated by a tangent parabola. What you then, in general, can do is the following. You can take your effective potential and you can expand it. You can expand it with respect to this quantity over here, with this guiding, what's called the guiding radius, right? Guiding radius. If you do that in a Taylor series, you get the following situation. Of course, you start with the leading term, which is the effective potential at the guiding radius and in the meridional plane of your system, plus possible terms that are proportional to the radius or the vertical height. But since this is a extremum at the radial orbit, at the circular orbit over here, those you already know will disappear. Consequently, you would expect more terms that are quadratic. That is to say, you expect an xz term, an x squared term, a z squared term, and higher order. Now, on the assumption that your system is reflection symmetric around the meridional plane, and we have already seen from the orbits that there is good reason for thinking so, this quantity here disappears, and therefore the first terms that appear in the Taylor expansion over and above this zero order term are the following. One half the second radial derivative with respect to the radius times x squared. And x is this radial deviation, as you have already seen, plus, obviously, a similar term, one half d second phi effective dz squared, okay, times z squared. And these derivatives, obviously, are to be taken at this point over here, at the guiding center. And then there will be higher order terms, but we will neglect those for the time being. What we can then do is to write down these derivatives in terms of a frequency. I had already indicated to you that in a parabolic potential, you have harmonic frequency, harmonic orbits, and harmonic means that you have only one characteristic frequency, and that characteristic frequency, of course, is related to this second derivative over here, because that gives you the sharpness, as it were, of that potential well. By definition, the square of one frequency, again, I'm not going to always remind you of the fact that it is going to be all evaluated at the guiding center over here. In the book, they use a correct notation, but I'm going to skip through that. This is defined as the second radial derivative of the effective frequency. That's this quantity over here. And then there is, of course, this quantity over here, and that is called nu squared, which is defined as the second derivative of the effective potential with respect to the height above the meridional plane. The virtue of doing this is that then your equations of motion turn out to be drastically simple. That is to say that the second derivative of this deviation over here, the deviation from a circular orbit, equals minus kappa squared times x, and then d second z dt squared equals minus nu squared times z. And that is precisely what I advertised earlier. That is to say, you have a harmonic oscillator in one direction superimposed on a harmonic oscillator in another direction, and that your general form of your equation in the sectional plane, your motion in the sectional plane, is going to be a Lissajous figure. In the literature, this quantity has gotten a name, and it is known as the epicyclic frequency. Why that is so, we will show in a moment when we talk about what the actual orbit of such a particle around the guiding center is going to be. For later use, we're not going to use that right here, but for use that you can perhaps make of this whole approximation elsewhere, I still want to indicate to you that there is a relationship between the epicyclic frequency and the orbital frequency. This, of course, is understandable because the epicyclic frequency here was taken at the guiding center. The guiding center means that I'm sitting at a particular point in the galaxy where I'm on a circular orbit. That circular orbit has a certain orbital frequency, which is called omega, capital omega, over here. Of course, that's immediately related to pi omega equals the orbital period, right? I mean, that is some so 1 over is the orbital period. The orbital frequency is directly related to the effective potential. Obviously, we had already seen that the characteristic time scale, t, is proportional to 1 over the square root of g times rho, and therefore is also proportional to a function of the potential over here. So whether or not you write this whole expression here in terms of the potential or in terms of the angular frequency is exactly the same. Right? Yeah, there's a one-to-one mapping between the effective potential and the angular frequency of the circular orbits. It turns out, if you do the computations, that this is to be written as follows: r times d omega squared dr plus 4 omega squared, right? So the epicyclic frequency changes as the orbital frequency changes also. Only for solid body rotation, this disappears, obviously, right? Well then, what can we say about the resulting orbits? I am not going to step through the various computations because they're relatively straightforward, and skip with you immediately to page 168, where the shape of the orbit around the guiding center is computed. By the way, I'm skipping this because there is a sort of formal relationship between these two quantities, which dynamically speaking, introduced in the way I did them, appear to be totally natural, right? Related to two other ways of writing these down, which are known as the Oort constants, which, as far as I'm concerned, are only of historical interest, and therefore I'm going to skip them right here. If you were to ask yourself, what does the orbit look like when I look at it from above, then you will get a little bit more understanding as why this is called the epicyclic frequency. So rather than using the sectional plane, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to look down along the z-axis onto the equatorial plane, on the meridional plane of this whole thing. So what we'd expect is that there would be a rotation around the guiding center with radius r0 with a characteristic frequency omega. On the other hand, you have this oscillatory motion with a characteristic frequency kappa in the radial direction. I'm forgetting for a moment the z oscillation here because this z thing is completely decoupled, as you can already see, from the other motion. Right, so we don't need to solve anything extra there. So let us consider what happens when our guiding center proceeds from one point to another when moving with it. Well, there's a motion in this direction, but at the same time, due to energy conservation, when you're a little bit away from the guiding center and you move in the inner direction, you will find that you go a little bit faster than otherwise, right? Because if you get closer to the center of such a potential, you are, you might call it, in the case of, if this is a point mass, you can call it Kepler's third law, if you will, but you go closer to here, so you move a little bit faster, which means that you proceed in this direction, and obviously you have the opposite in this side. So you would expect that the oscillatory motion in the radial direction is, for energy conservation reasons, related to a oscillatory motion in the direction, so along the orbit over here. So consequently, when you have, in this particular diagram, a counterclockwise movement of your guiding center, you will have a simultaneous clockwise movement on a small ellipse about the guiding center over here. It turns out that if you do your sums correctly, that the ratio of the long axis and the short axis of this ellipse for a Keplerian potential is 2:1. So it's twice as long as it is wide. Even so, you now also understand why this is called the epicyclic frequency, because in the, shall we say, pre-Copernican days, or pre-Keplerian days, should I perhaps say, the planetary motion was considered to be composed of a circular motion in one direction and superimposed a circular epicyclic motion in the other. And in this case, you can see that they got it close but no cigar, so to speak, right? So the actual ratio of this ellipse is not 1:1, as it would be for a circle, but it is 1:2. Well then, by the way, just a footnote, the actual ratio that you do get depends on the behavior of the potential, obviously, because how fast you start to speed up when you go inward depends, of course, on what the potential does when you move away a little bit from this circular orbit. I want to conclude today by showing you a number of numerical computations of what happens under these circumstances if you add to the effective potential yet another term, which is perhaps of some interest. And that is the following. Let us assume now that what we are doing is we are following an object in a circular orbit. But now, instead of just using that moving point as a purely mathematical guiding center, something that is just there in order to compute the effective potential, what I'm going to now do is take that circular orbit, occupy that circular orbit by an actual body, an actual object, the mass of which is totally negligible compared with the overall mass of this effective potential over here, but still it is finite. And we're going to see what happens. I'm going to take again those co-rotating coordinates that I just mentioned, in the sense that what you will see here is a little piece of this motion over here with the radial direction like this and the tangential direction like that. I will use the epicyclic approximation, and I want to emphasize to you that what you're going to see when you add a gravitating point here, rather than just leave that guiding center mathematically empty, is the following. Such an object tries to attract other objects in its vicinity. But what's going to happen is something that, to a first approximation, seems counterintuitive. Suppose that you are on an inner orbit over here, and you want to... suppose that you are on the same orbit over here, and you want to overtake that point over there. You can do this, for instance, because of a gravitational attraction between the two. So you're gravitationally attracted to this point, and you go move faster and faster towards it. What is going to happen in an actual case? Well, you add energy to this point. But when you add energy, you go to a bigger orbit, and the bigger orbit is outside. You know from Kepler's third law, or from the relationship between the angular frequency and the radius here, the rotation curve, in other words, of a galaxy, that when you're further out, you go slower. In other words, when you are attracted to this object over here, you go to a higher energy orbit, and that orbit is slower, so you remain behind. That is very counterintuitive. A gravitating object acts, in this case, effectively as something that repels rather than attracts. So you have something that acts, in a sense, as negative gravity. The example I'm going to give you is an observation from Saturn's rings, but also we will see that this is relevant for planet formation. And this is, of course, a slight sideline in what I've just been mentioning in the case of the typical stellar system. But as we will see later when we talk about the encounters between dwarf galaxies in the course of merging of galaxies, this is also important. There again, I have an object over here, and the coordinates are such that in the horizontal direction you move along the circular orbit, and in the vertical direction you move inward in the down direction and outward in the up direction. So that's the radial coordinate. What I've computed here is what happens if you take a whole series of particles over here and you give them initial conditions that correspond to circular rotation. So every point coming in here, it's been color-coded to go from all the way dark red all the way to white. Every point here comes in with a speed that corresponds to its circular orbit. Every point here is then gravitationally attracted by this object over here, which is just shaded. It has zero extent. It is, in fact, a Plummer potential, an orbiting Plummer potential. And you see that in this vicinity over here, particles that start on a circular orbit inside get repelled in co-rotating coordinates and get busted out in this direction. So you can see this effective repulsion in this case. Now, I'm going to remove the object over here to give you a clearer view of what happens. The particles on the other side over here would come in the same way. They move a little bit more slowly, so they are moving in this direction here. They're being overtaken, as it were, by this object that is orbiting here. And when you add the two together, this is the response that you would expect. If you had an orbiting gravitating body, a gravitating body with a gravity that is much smaller than the overall gravity that creates the circular orbits here and there, and that acts effectively in its neighborhood as something that repels, as a repulsive force, and it throws out all the particles in this vicinity here in some sort of S-shaped spiral type structure. And this, then, you ought to see as a very small section of the overall behavior of this system over here. What I'm going to present to you now are a number of these simulations, except with more and more particles. Right, so this is almost the same simulation, except with a slightly larger coordinate volume. And you can already see that the orbits over here that are being repelled by this object here form something that looks like an envelope, which is relatively sharply defined. Making the power off, are you guys kidding? What have I done wrong? Press any other button. Any other button. Many. Things are taking over. This is precisely the same computation, except now we don't use this small coordinate volume anymore, but to make it a little bit bigger. And you see that the envelope of the orbits, the repelled orbits over here, gives some sort of wave that is being imposed on this structure over here. So we get two things simultaneously. We get a wave-like response in the bottom part, and here particles are being expelled, are going to be pushed away. Now, let us see what happens in that case, right? You put them together, you get something that looks like a wave plus something that gets repelled, and it is all a consequence of our dear Huygens friend. Okay, one more case in point. This wave plus evacuation is sort of shown in various cases. Here I've taken the same type of computation here, but now with many, 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 many orbits, about 5,000 or so of those orbits taken together. So you get this particular region around and about the circular orbit. Particles are being pushed away, so you get a opening, as it were, in this area, and you get a wave on both sides of this particle over here. These are some photographs of the rings of Saturn, where you see some of those waves, in fact, propagating. Again, let us compare the computation here with what is actually observed. This is a small satellite in the rings of Saturn called Daphnis, and you can see precisely what I've shown you over here. And that is theoretically understandable now in this epicycle approximation. This thing here acts effectively as a repelling force rather than as an attracting force, and it induces a wave and a groove inside this system. Now, this is a generic mechanism, and interestingly enough, it is important just about everywhere. This is a case in point where you have a small satellite in the rings of Saturn, not quite in this thing here. There's a little wave that it induces over here, and you see those waves propagating in the Saturn's rings. Those are the very vague inner rings of Saturn. To conclude, this is a snapshot from the PhD thesis by Simeon Pyrdekoper, who studied the formation of planets. Now here, what we have is no longer n-body dynamics, but it is actual gas dynamics. So you see the response here of the gas in a disk, where here you have a small attracting object over here that is a growing planet, and you can already see that this shape of this thing over here corresponds very nicely to what I've shown to you previously in the case of Saturn's rings, except that in this case, the mass of this object is so big that the wave extends to much bigger distances than only the circumference of this little bit over here. Similar situation over here, but then a moment later, and you see that this area here has been evacuated by the gravitational attraction of this object over here. And this, we presume, is responsible for the formation of planetary systems, where you have a planet at one place, and then a little bit of nothing, and then another planet further out, etc., etc. This image here shows a case in point from somebody else's computation. You start with this disk over here. An object starts to coagulate and induces this spiral that I already mentioned to you earlier, that we now understand because we can co-move with this object over here. And here you see the consequences of the effective potential, as it were, in front of your face, except that now we have added to this the gravitational attraction by this object over here. When these waves here become nonlinear, you get other objects that start to form, like here and here and here. And due to their self-gravity, then, we presume that these, in the fullness of time, will form other planets or planetesimals in such a system. The reason I wanted to make this little digression is to show to you that the n-body dynamics that we've been talking about so far, in terms of the effective potential, is in fact very much further applicable than only in the case of galaxy n-body systems.